The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Mary Roach's new book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, which examines the history of research on copulation. She describes the evolution of sex research from studies by Alfred Kinsey and the lesser-known Robert Latou Dickinson, a Brooklyn-based gynecologist, to the Egyptian Dr. Ahmed Shafiq, who dressed rats in polyester pants, and whose surgical specialty, as far as Roach can determine, is despots with colorectal issues. Roach's previous works include Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers on the Science of Death, and Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, A Look at What Happens After We Die. Mary has always gravitated towards the peculiar, covering things like Eskimo food, flatulence, killer bees, vaginal weightlifting, carrot addiction, and amputee bowling leagues. Her magazine pieces have run in Outside, National Geographic, New Scientist, Wired, and the New York Times Magazine, and her 1995 article, How to Win at Germ Warfare, was a National Magazine Award finalist. In conversation with Mary Roach tonight is Beth Lapidus. I'm sure many of you know Beth from the UN Cabaret. Beth is an author, comedian, teacher, activist, radio and TV personality, and former First Lady candidate. She's appeared on CNN, Politically Incorrect, and HBO's Sex and the City. She's the founder of the groundbreaking alternative comedy show UN Cabaret, and her most recent show, which she previewed on the stage for Aloud, is called 100% Happy 88% of the Time, which is really fun. Beth is the author of Did I Wake You? Haikus for Modern Living. Now, why Mary Roach and Beth Lapidus together? Well, both Mary and Beth are graced by an insatiable curiosity, a keen intelligence, and a wicked sense of humor. And I've also noticed that neither of them is intimidated by talking to experts. So let's see what happens. Please welcome Mary Roach and Beth Lapidus.
Hello.
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 Hello. Also, Louise did not point out we both have ruffles,
pointy shoes, neutral colors.
You are neutral colors. So many things. Hi, Mary. Hi, you guys. We're going to start with the...
We thought we'd put it... I'm going to follow up on Louise's comment that this is a sexy item. And at first glance, you would think, possibly not. Requires reading glasses to read, which is possibly sexy, I don't know.
To some.
I think here we have the makings of a cock ring emergency situation, so... It's possibly it is a very sexy mug, and you should certainly consider adding one to your life.
Oh, and also, you can put, you know, many bodily fluids into it, and that would be also...
This certainly, yes.
Certainly
it's
sexy.
A large capacity. Yeah.
Okay.
Probably I could go in the bores, actually, bore ejaculate, it's almost like a cup and a half. So, perfect for... artificial inseminators in the crowd. I don't know.
Are there any, by the way, artificial inseminators in the crowd? That's a yes, I think.
I guess so.
Well, one thing, Mary, I noticed about your work is it's about bodies. Bodies, both Stiff and Spook and...
Right.
Now, Bonk.
I like that because a lot of people have said, you seem to be hung up on death. And I always correct them. I said, not death. The after part, the bodies. It was a body book, definitely a body book.
Right.
This is a body book, warm bodies this time instead of cold, basically the only difference between the two books.
There you go. So, and then also the disembodied, right?
And then the disembodied, the non-bodied, those people who miss their body and are disassociated from it. Yeah, so yeah, I never really, it wasn't an intentional.
It wasn't?
No, nothing really in my career has been particularly intentional. A pretty passive course from one... in lame endeavor to the next.
Really? Is that how you are in your life as well? Also, you kind of go with the flow? Or more in your work and less in your life, not as much going with the flow?
Yeah, going with the flow in a very distracted way. I have a very short attention span. If you watch me try to, my husband Ed is a good, otherwise also Woody, he's the Woody at the beginning. I figured Woody was more appropriate as the dedication, that's his nickname. It's not actually the nickname of his penis, which people have been assuming.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I really did think that was the case.
Anyway, he cooks, and I try to, you know, I do the dishes, and I set the table, and it's amazing to watch me set the table, because it'll be the placemats, possibly sometimes even the napkins, then I wander off, you know, and Ed will come in and go, nice job. Yeah. Oh, yeah, silverware.
But
yeah,
he's
distracted.
There's two things that makes, okay. Jumping. I'm just jumping now because there's one thing I remember from the book very clearly that you said, one of your favorite quotes was the thing with the two mice.
Oh, yeah. My favorite, I guess I never really thought I identify with this, but my favorite line in the oeuvre, is that how you say that word?
Yes.
Oeuvre. The oeuvre.
Oeuvre.
As opposed to the hors d'oeuvre,
yes,
of Alfred Kinsey. Here's my favorite line, and I slogged through a lot of the Kinsey's books. Cheese crumbs spread in front of a pair of copulating rats will distract the female, but not the male.
I wondered why it was your favorite line, but now I see.
Yeah.
Was there something more to it than that, or did you just identify with that female rat?
Just the distraction element.
I see.
Not necessarily the distracted during sex, but
yes.
Just as a general baseline state of mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
look over there.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, over there. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Oh, sorry, I got distracted. Well, you know, what struck me about that also was, and maybe this is reading too much into it, but, you know, what that quote sort of says is that sex in some way is about paying attention.
Yes.
And science is also about paying attention.
True.
So science about sex is sort of paying attention to paying attention.
Paying attention to paying attention.
Yes.
That's true. There was Masters and Johnson coined this wonderful term called spectatoring, which is not expectorating.
I see.
Spectatoring, which was, this was a problem with particularly with women who would suddenly be sort of watching themselves in the act and thinking, my ass looks huge, and what am I doing, and and then it was very detrimental to good sex, and so, yeah. Spectatoring. So don't spectator.
Don't spectate.
But this was tied in with
I hear a lot of people thinking, my ass is kind of big, though. How am I going to get around this? You know, in meditation, of course, that's called like the witness. So you want the witness instead of the spectator.
Yes, mindfulness training was actually something somebody recommended as a technique for better sex, just being in the moment and not wandering off, not dissociating from your body, etc. So
good to be in the moment. And then if the sex isn't good, at least you're in the moment. It's a plus. Something, you got something. All right, so good. Around the house, of course, we call bonk stupt, but there's some
issue. Stupt would have been good.
Was there always bonk?
Well, there was a quite protracted bonk boink debate that carries on in actually most interviews that I do and a lot of appearances. People say, excuse me, I believe there's a typo on the cover of your book. So much so that they're both, if you look in the online dictionary.com, they're both actually there. They're technically both words for slang for sexual intercourse. Boink is a little more common, but we felt that, you know, bonk is kind of onomatopoeic.
Yes.
Bonk.
Yes.
Whereas boink kind of reminded me of, you know, the old Don Martin cartoons in Mad Magazine where the guy gets hit on the back and his false eyeball pops out and lands
boing,
on the floor.
Boing, boing.
That's boink. That's boink.
That's
me.
Actually boing.
Actually, I think, you know what, it was dit, 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 I think. But that kind of thing, and it didn't feel like sex to me.
It's all kind of dribbly, isn't it? Yeah.
The eyeball coming out?
Yeah.
It is.
Nunk.
So I'm thinking, actually, it's become such an issue that I'm going to get little letter I's that you can peel and stick, and I will hand them out at readings for the people who are uncomfortable with the choice of bonk over boink.
Perhaps sell them at readings.
Or sell them.
Because, you know, that could be good. The good side business.
I could sign the I's.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
All right. So Let's talk about how the book changed you.
Yes, now. Okay. How the book changed me.
How the book changed you, Mary. How are you different now?
I seem to have suddenly become a sex therapist, because now I went to my second reading, Kepler's bookstore. I'm probably outing someone now, but one of the employees came up and said, you know, since my heart attack, I haven't had an erection in about 10 years, and what's interesting is you can still ejaculate, you can still have an orgasm without an erection. It's a fascinating thing. So I'm having these conversations constantly with total strangers, actually about averaging 2 a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you keeping track of them for, like, the follow-up?
I'm going to start charging money.
I think so.
This
is your second side business I've come up with tonight.
What was the other one?
Well, you're selling your eyes, and now you're charging for the therapy.
I'm going to cut you in, Beth. Yeah. Don't worry.
So, and do you find that you're actually able to help people?
You know, I haven't actually been able to follow them home into the bedroom and see if it's working. But I do liberally dispense advice for which I am completely unqualified to give. Oh. I'm joining the masses of people in this country who...
Oh, there you go.
Hand it out. Why not?
And now I know you're just at the beginning of the book tour, but do you find men and women, or mostly men? Or
Men and women.
Men and women.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what kind of problems do the women want?
Well, sometimes you get call-in radio is always entertaining with a sex book. Is you get you get someone who's calling in, and like this morning someone called, hopefully he's not here, but someone called in and said, well, you know, I wanted to tell you about this penis surgery that I had, and I looked into lengthening surgery. That didn't seem quite right for me, and so then I found this guy who would take sort of a piece of tissue from your gluteal fold and actually create sort of an implant to increase the girth, and he went into this great detail, and we're clicking down to 2:30 and time to get off the phone, and the DJ said, well, was it a good thing for you? I mean, was it?
do you have a question? Also,
yeah. Do you have a question? I didn't. You know, what do you say? But
good for you.
Good for you. That's great.
Do you think so? You know, the book covers really the history of scientific inquiry into
It's in a word, it's sex labs. It's not the behavioral surveys that Kinsey did, and it's not people looking at risk-taking behaviors, etc. It's studying the physiology of arousal and orgasm in a lab. Because what I found fascinating was, I mean, sex is this very personal and intimate thing that is nonetheless a biological, physiological process and deserves to be studied. But how the hell do you do it? And, you know, what got me interested in the book was I came across a mention of the Masters and Johnson penis camera, which was this extraordinary device, which was essentially an acrylic see-through phallus with a tiny movie camera and a light source. And it was attached to a motor so that it you know, did like a penis. And they would actually film the woman's response from the inside. And I thought, wow. I mean, because...
See, I hear that
right
and I
there.
Think, ow.
Yeah,
ow.
And it had some sort of a lever to control the speed and the depth and everything, and it was, but you know, when you think about it, it's a brilliant idea, because how else would you ever be able to see what's going on inside of a woman who's becoming sexually aroused?
And how even then can you see? I mean, were
they little teeny tiny lights? No, they were. And you look in their book, they figured out where vaginal lubrication comes from. They have this little illustration with these. It looks like little, like a passing spring rain, little drops coming down.
That was a very striking part of the book too. The whole idea of moisture, and describe the Greek thing where it was like men would play women on stage.
Yeah. I just was making this aside, just this casual observation that seemed to me in depictions of female arousal historically, hyperbole seems to be the way to go. With Greek actors playing sexually aroused women would actually have little buckets of sloshing water between their legs. And some of the Japanese woodcuts, it's like a, you know, Coca-Cola ad with it pouring out. I got off on a little lubrication side trip for a while.
Not a bad place to go.
No.
So, all right, so you see this one fact. Just let's talk a little bit about how the book happens. You find right. this, you really, the, that was
that
the
was,
fact.
That was, I was, yeah, lying in bed, reading Film Quarterly, no idea where I got a copy of Film Quarterly. Don't subscribe, don't know where it came from, but I do remember it was Film
Magic.
Quarterly, and they were talking about the films that Masters and Johnson made this way. And that was it. That was literally where I said, next book, sex research.
Yeah. And then from there, you started to look into this whole sex labs. And
well, yeah. At that point, I thought, you know, time to write a book proposal, which is a sales tool that makes me appear to know something about a topic I know absolutely nothing about, other than the fact that Masters and Johnson at one point made this really bizarre machine. So I do this proposal, and then I, you know, sell the book, and then comes the time where I have to track down some researchers and convince them that it's a great idea to let me come into the lab while they have a subject, you know, and they're like, I'm sorry, you want to come and observe someone coming and masturbating in an MRI machine? And how is that going to work? And they'd, so invariably, not invariably, but occasionally what would happen is they'd say, well, if you wanted to be the subject yourself, that would be a way to get around this particular obstacle and thereby create a different kind of obstacle.
What was the phrase that they used? Not your organization.
Oh yeah, yeah. The main event in the book, I guess the main Mary event is my poor, long-suffering husband Ed and I went to be filmed in four-dimensional ultrasound having sex, and I had to which is quite a challenge to do that, but even more of a challenge to convince your husband that this is a good idea. So yeah, I initially wrote to them and said, you know, I heard about this project, your next project with this fascinating new technology that you have developed, and I'd love to come for this historic undertaking. I'd love to attend. This is sorry. This historic undertaking, and I got this wonderful note back. Dear Mrs. Roach, you know, I would be happy to be interviewed if you come to London. Unfortunately, we don't have a brave couple for intimate study, is how he put it. So he said, if your organization can provide someone, I would be happy to oblige. So my organization gave it some thought. My organization called its husband. Do you know how you haven't been to Europe in 25 years? It'll be really fun. We can go to a play. We can see Stonehenge. Anyway.
But you mentioned in the book that Ed was not interested neither in a play nor Stonehenge.
No.
Which
Ed,
I
no.
was very distracted by.
Ed was he's just an incredibly supportive.
He seems very nice.
He's a really good guy.
Yeah.
He's just the ultimate good sport guy. Yeah.
Is he also a writer?
No, he's a designer and illustrator. He's a visual arts
kind
of guy. Yeah.
Words and pictures all
Words
together.
And pictures.
Somebody who can cook and somebody who can't quite set the table.
That is Ed and Mary.
That's nice. So what was the ultrasound? What was it like to get the ultrasound?
Oh, yeah. The ultrasound, well, okay. It was sex, technically, definitely. But the thing is, it really felt like it felt more like a medical procedure. And
right.
it had that same kind of, that surreal, obligatory quality. And you go into the doctor and you just never know. And he's going to say something like, okay, now I'm going to stick my gloved finger in your rectum. And you go, okay, because you're there. And what is, you know, you're just going to get through whatever it is that they want you to get through. And so that was really, I was taking notes, actually. Because we had
wow, lucky Ed.
I know. It's just every man's nightmare. He had us, because the ultra, you have to get the wand right here.
Right.
And I guess it never occurred to him to do some sort of me on top thing. So we're like, you know, the spoon kind of, this right. may be too much. Is this really awful? This has happened to me that I find myself, you know, addressing large groups of people, talking about the sexual particulars of my life and throwing around, you know, words like orgasm and intercourse. And I don't know, maybe it's completely inappropriate.
No, I don't think so.
But anyway.
But we can stop
so,
anytime.
Okay, so, and the thing that was just.
You're ready with the cock ring, oh, number one thing.
the thing with the, with ultrasound is that you may or may not be aware is that water is a good conductor of ultrasound waves. So he instructed me to drink a lot of tea or liquids before going in. And this particular position, as you will see if you go on the internet and look at the footage, the penis is like poking into the bladder. So I'm like, God, when is it going to be over? And poor Ed is just like, just let me get through this. He's taken a Viagra. And this is the kind of research that literally never happened before Viagra. There was an MRI project. They wanted to do an MRI of a couple having sex. This was in the Netherlands. And they actually got some couples, but they had to hold still for a minute. Well, you know, it's, you know, that's the way snails have sex, but not people. And they shelved the whole thing until Viagra came along.
Really?
Yeah. And then, you know, now they had six or seven people who actually did it in the MRI.
Wow.
Yeah.
But so you'll go down in history for this, if nothing else. I mean, your place
I'm pretty
secure.
Much done now.
You're done.
I can retire.
You're golden.
Yeah.
All right. So you did the MRI and...
Ultrasound, yeah.
Oh, ultrasound, yeah.
That's
yes.
Okay. It's a common mistake.
Very common mistake,
Very common mistake, I'm sure.
And they took the wand and they just...
So he's holding the... And Ed said afterward, his hand was resting on my hip. It was kind of weird. Oh. Like, of all that, like, the...
Like the strangest three-way ever.
This. Yeah, it was. And Dr. Deng is like just very, very excited that we're getting the image. You know, and really, honestly, I don't, because people think, oh, come on, what, this guy's definitely a perv, you know.
Right.
It's like, no, he's definitely not. He was just so, but he was so sweet, really, because he said, you know, Ed said at one point, you know, we're trying to like kind of like make like the situation a little more bearable. And Ed said, well, you know, where's the candlelight and soft music? You know, because it's an MRI. It's a...
You did it. Ultrasound, Mary.
It's a common mistake. So, anyway, yeah, and he said, he goes, oh, I'm sorry. And then he goes, oh, wait, on my laptop, I have the soundtrack to Les Mis. That's okay. Really, it's okay.
What's sexier than Les Mis, first of all?
Yeah,
that's
or a loud mug.
Yeah. So that's one way you changed. We're here. Hello. So you changed because now you've made world history. And
yes, I've...
Your ultrasound. And what did they learn from that ultrasound? Was there some sort of helpful science?
You know, what they basically learned is, hey, it worked.
Oh, I see.
Now,
okay.
The MRI, for example, this is one of those let's do it and see if we learn anything types of studies. Uh-huh. Like the MRI, here's what they learned from the MRI, which was 1991. They learned that the penis during intercourse has the shape of a boomerang. Okay. Wait, because they also learned it.
I just felt like I'm in sixth grade.
What? No. Okay. I should have told you the first part of that. What they learned, which will make more sense.
Okay.
They learned that the root of the penis is 2/3 again the length of the hangy downy part. Okay.
I love that fact.
Yeah. So you can now, you know, if you say you're 6 inches, you can say you're 10, and I can back you up. It's absolutely true. They didn't realize how far in there it goes.
Well, that's a big deal.
Yeah, no.
That's
huge. The root of the penis.
The root of the penis.
It's a rooted item.
Honey, you're rootless. Fabulous. but what I love about that in a profound way, that did really strike me when I read it, was, you know, so much of, like, I don't know, just the whole idea of rootedness in humanity and how much, you know...
Nice segue.
The profound part of sexuality, and that, you know, how much is unseen, which is really, you know, right. you think the penis is like the ultimate of, it's all out there.
No one knew. And because there's, you go back to Leonardo da Vinci, not DiCaprio, Leonardo. Although, who knows, he may have done some research of his own. Leonardo da Vinci had these amazing, they were these cutaway figures, the coition figures they're called, and they're these really detailed but hopelessly inaccurate drawings, because the way Leonardo studied anatomy was to use cadavers. And, you know, while I suppose you could take two cadavers and muscle, you know, sort of muscle them into the missionary position, you know,
that's
and then
your
cut
both
them
of
in
your
half,
books combined now.
That would be, yes. Yeah, you really couldn't really know by studying cadavers what actually happens when two people have sex. So he kind of just borrowed it from some ancient Arab texts and got it wrong. You know, had basically the penis kind of actually interlocking into the cervix, kind of like the space shuttle docking with a space station. And it was believed that if you didn't have a good interlock, that you couldn't, that maybe that would contribute right. to a conception of a fertility problem. And uh-huh. so they were wrong about this for centuries.
And yet the idea of interlock is intriguing.
The idea of it, yes.
But you
You'll need to rearrange your cervix, Beth, because it just kind of doesn't work that quite well.
I know, but nevertheless, interlock.
It is interlocking. Well, dogs, they have an interlock situation.
Do they?
They do,
an interlock situation.
Yeah, well, different kind, but it's not cervical. I don't really know what it is. But
that's your next book.
It's in here. There is a dog. There's a some, yeah, whatever.
I like the idea personally of upsuck.
Upsuck,
and
yeah.
we've really tried to integrate the idea of upsuck into our life at home,
wherever you can.
At our organization, Mary, upsuck has very big. I don't care for this project, upsuck. Greg. There's too much upsuck in it.
A lot of upsuck. The more common phrase was insuck, but I just took my liberties and decided. You know, there were two guys who said upsuck, and everybody else used insuck. So I liked upsuck. So
it's a good
upsuck.
Word.
It became
upsuck. It is. I see it. It's
maybe
gonna
we
be
should
rap
tell
songs
people what upsuck is. Or
you
should we
could
just keep throwing the word back and forth.
Everyone
upsuck,
wants
okay. Upsuck. This was interesting because it's one of those things that you would think science would have figured out for sure, but it was the idea is that when a woman has an orgasm, that the contractions suck up the semen like literally like a straw into through the cervix, and you know, thereby delivering it quickly to the egg,
okay.
and that would be a fertility booster. And this goes it's an idea that goes way back to the Habsburg Empire. There was actually a Princess Maria Theresa having trouble conceiving, and the advice that she was given from the court physician was, I am of the opinion that the vulva of your most sacred majesty should be titillated for some time before intercourse. And she then had 18 children. So,
wow.
So it's like kind of anecdotal stuff that put upsuck right on the map. And then Masters and Johnson, this is the most amazing thing. Masters and Johnson, they were quite vigorous upsuck skeptics, which is even more fun to say than just upsuck. upsuck skeptics, they did this extraordinary study because they didn't buy it, the whole upsuck thing. So they had women come in and they had a cervical cap, and in that they put this simulated semen, you know, same surface tension, same density, and it had a radio opaque thing so it would show up on an x-ray. So they've got the cap with the fake semen on the cervix, they put the women in front of an x-ray machine, and they have them masturbate and have an orgasm, and then they had these x-rays said, see, no upsuck. But, I mean, I'm like, wow, where did you even get the, who figured out the simulated semen? I mean, this is so many, in fact, I found three recipes.
For simulated semen?
I did, yeah. And
not in Film Quarterly, you didn't find
no,
those,
not
did
in, not in Film Quarterly.
What's the best recipe? Should
well,
we need
first,
to make
the one
some?
Is, there's one in the book. It involves cornstarch and water, but my favorite part is that at the bottom, you know, on like a cupcake recipe, they'll say, yield 2 dozen cupcakes. It says, yield, colon, one ejaculate. So... They should say human
because not a boar.
Yes, not
true. Boar ejaculate.
It's true, absolutely true.
Now, you brought up Leonardo and the whole idea of, you know, interlocking like space. And I got the sense as I was finishing the book, and each thing got figured out, but then it was just more mysterious.
Well, the upsock, yeah, I never told you the upshot of the upsock.
There you go.
Story. Masters and Johnson had no, it showed no, oh no, I did say that there was no, they had no upsock.
No upsuck.
No evidence on there. Then some, of course, as always happens with science, someone came back and said, this is a flawed study because the cap would block the suction. You would have a vacuum or something like that, and they said it wouldn't work. Others pointed out that you actually wouldn't want upsuck because sperm take time to capacitate, and if you just immediately shove them up to the egg, they're not ready. They would be duds. So you wouldn't even want it to happen. So... what? Still, even today, the upsuck debate continues.
that's what it really struck me is like so much debate really continues that like the more I read the book, this was my personal experience with your book, Mary, was that I started to feel like my innards were like outer space and that more was known about the heavens and what was in, I mean, a lot of it I never thought about, you know, if it's not broke, don't try to fix
no,
it. It all
think,
seemed good.
Right.
And then I was reading your book. I was like, oh, wait.
No, it's true. I mean, I don't know if anyone here has ever read Human Sexual Response, Masters and Johnson, 1966.
Has anyone, by the way?
Yeah, see, it's, well... Okay,
couple
there you
people
go.
Over here.
It's an,
you
it's
might
an
be able to get a mug for free for that.
It's an extraordinary, correct me if I'm wrong, it's an extraordinary book in that you're reading, I mean, they documented every little element of the what they called the sexual response cycle. Everything was a cycle. They like made sex sound like, you know, washing machine
punching.
Yeah. It was like, but they, it was, you'd be reading along, you go, wow, I never knew at a certain point the clitoris retracts under its little hood and disappears. And you think, well, now, so that could be troubling to somebody who is working with it and loses it and thinks, I broke it, you know, it's gone, you know. So it was amazing to me and kind of enlightening and ultimately distracting because, you know, all these things you're learning, you're thinking, oh, is this the part where, like, the earlobes swell, you know?
So you're doing all this research. What's the process of like finding all this out and then, you know, sort of making sense of it? Is that for someone distracted? I think that would be hard. A lot of facts.
Yeah. Well, my books are kind of, the process is sort of organic. I don't have an outline. I don't know what's going to, you know, there's sometimes I'll think though, okay, here's three chapters. Those fit nicely together.
Right.
And I don't know where that chunk's going to go. And
right.
Invariably my editor will get the draft and say, we're not leading with this chapter. It's too slow. This is the one that should go here, which of course completely screws me up because I've got to change all the transitions. But it's a very kind of fluid and haphazard process, really. Some reviewer described my book as lightly organized. Which I thought was a nice way to put it.
Which sounds like your life a little bit.
Lightly organized.
Lightly organized.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's...
Well, it is sort of, I mean, organic. I think it's
organic, yeah.
Organically.
Organic. And...
Do you love the research? Do you love it?
No, I love the research. It was some other reviewer was saying you can just, you know, picture Mary Roach, like when she finds like the Kinsey rats with the cheese crumbs, uh-huh. going, yes. And it's really true. I do. I find something and I go, oh, yeah, this is good stuff. I can't wait to figure out where I'm going to put it in and fit it in. Frequently, stuff doesn't really fit in anywhere, but that doesn't stop me. I just, there are actually more than twice as many footnotes in Bonk as there were in Stiff. So, yeah, and possibly a few too many. It's a little distracting. But you can skip
enjoyable.
Them.
I found them quite enjoyable.
The footnotes are, yeah.
You can always leave them. You don't have...
Should we share
please,
the
yes,
footnote?
Why don't you read
okay.
a footnote?
I'm going to read my favorite footnote.
Please do.
That's the only reading
yes.
I'm going to do. It's short. Okay. Okay. Grandma. All right. This is a footnote that... okay, well, it's a discussion that has to do with a rectal electro-ejaculator, but we don't need to go into that, right? So, there is a good reason for why that's in the book, but okay. And in the course of this, I stumbled onto a paper called, this is a journal paper, serious scholarly academic paper called Rectal Foreign Bodies, colon. Well, yep, the punctuation, yes. I guess that could be confusing. Case reports and a comprehensive review of the world's literature. Okay, and it includes this fabulous list of objects doctors have removed from rectums over the years. And I have just this list of highlights. Okay, a frozen pigtail. That's one of seven female cases in a total caseload of 202. A bottle of impulse body spray. This was, incarcerated was the term they used. incarcerated in a 37-year-old lawyer. And the lawyer is the only occupation they felt the need to put in the... I don't know. No one else did they specify the occupation. A parsnip. A plantain, parentheses, with condom, because you never know what you're going to catch from a plantain. A dull knife. A cattle horn, a salami, a jeweler's saw, and a plastic spatula. Okay, multiple holdings in the same rectum are listed under the heading collections. and these include several that could pass as still life titles, and those would be oil can with potato, two apples, and 402 stones.
Jeez. Not pebbles, stones.
No, stones. And then there were several that probably could not pass as still life titles, those being umbrella handle and enema tubing, lemon and cold cream jar, and lastly, one that suggests a quiet evening at the Biltmore, that being spectacles, suitcase key, tobacco pouch, and magazine. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you can see why, even though it wasn't strictly germane to the discussion in the book, I had to kind of get it
you
in
can't
there.
Leave
get
that
it in
up.
There, so to speak.
I can't believe they didn't put what magazine it was. That really would have filled the picture out.
That's the thing with sex research. They're so researchers and academics, the people who are writing these papers, they're so stingy with the irrelevant details. You know, I so crave them. Like Masters and Johnson would say, you know, when they had that study where, you know, one study where couples would come in and have sex, some of them long-term couples, some of them matched up for the occasion, amazingly. And they said some of them requested music. And I so was like, what music? You know, come on, just one LP title. But no.
The Last Dance?
Yeah.
What is
Bolero?
It? What is it? Should we take some questions?
Absolutely.
Is it time?
Sure.
I think it might be time. Ladies and gentlemen, questions for Mary? The microphone right here. I am. I'm waiting for a hand to go up. Nice lady with the orange shirt.
I feel kind of sorry for the poor lady with the multiple sclerosis and you climbing on the ladder and the...
Oh, but I was only looking at the experimental setup. Actually, it wasn't I climbed up on the desk.
Yeah.
Right. But that was, I didn't see her. I should have made that clear.
Oh,
the experimental setup, yeah.
Okay.
She was under the covers, too. So.
So you're good now. You feel really, you no longer feel sorry for her. But do you feel sorry for Mary? Other questions?
I have an upsup question.
I knew upsup was going to be hot.
My favorite kind.
Only because, and this is scary that they showed this in like the fifth grade, but I could have sworn that I've seen a video of...
see how it feels?
Of a penis head ejaculating and the cervix like dipping down into the lake of...
Oh, yes. No. That is... That's a separate,
separate?
A phenomenon. it does actually. Well, I know actually. There's a portion where it's tenting. It's actually pulling away. But the dipping down. That was a claim.
I'm
that
not
the upsuck people. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They did make. There was this amazing.
Like into the lake of ejaculation.
There was a reservoir. I've heard reservoir as well. The reservoir. But the thing is, if the woman was on top, the reservoir would be spilling out of its confines anyway, so the whole thing is kind of, it's sort of missionary position centric, but yes, there was actually the person who championed upsuck was this bizarre guy, Dr. Beck, in the late 1800s, who found this woman who had a prolapsed uterus, so that it was right at the front, it was visible right at the door of her vagina, and she was actually she claimed, oh, all you have to do is touch me and I have an orgasm, and he described her cervix making five or six successive gasps, and he said it actually resembles the freshwater fish called the sucker.
Oh my God.
So, but anyway, yeah, maybe that was, but you saw actual footage of
it? Yeah, footage of... Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Footage of upsuck?
Because others have said that the cervix actually pulls away like a circus tent kind of. So that therefore upsuck makes no sense because the straw isn't even in the milk or whatever. The sucking thing isn't in the reservoir.
But actually what I'm remembering now that there was this was fascinating that there was upsuck and there was the opposite of upsuck that happened in different parts of the cycle.
Right.
And that it was just, and this is what I loved. It's not always the same.
Right. There was, at a certain, like, during ovulation, you would have the upsucking, whereas during your period, it would be the contractions would be expulsive. So your body is a wonder, basically.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's all. All right. Other questions? Right, this gentleman up front, and then right behind him. We'll do right up front first. Nice blue shirt, man.
In the introduction, there was mention of an Egyptian scientist involving polyester. Could you talk about that and possibly some of the other more exotic researches you learned about?
This is a Professor Shafik, or Shafiq. Actually, they maybe just to be nice to me because I was mispronouncing it, they kept calling him Shafiq, but Shafiq. I think Shafiq is more common. Anyway, he came to my attention because he's one of the few researchers who still does pure physiology of, like, he does these studies, the reflexes of intercourse, and he does these amazing, partly amazing because he manages to get women in a conservative Muslim country to come in and participate. He pays them. And they're prostitutes, but still and all.
But let's do a footnote on the prostitutes, which I thought was an interesting side note on this, that the prostitutes were sort of middle class women who were widows.
They were divorced because the average age was 37 or 38, and I said, what? So your prostitutes are a lot older in Egypt, and they explain that they are divorced women without any money to put their children through school, et cetera. And so
the way it came off in the book, or what my understanding was that they liked having sex. There was no other way to do it.
There were some. This woman, apparently, he claimed that she wasn't doing it for the money. She was doing it because she couldn't otherwise, as a single woman, ever have sex. Who knows?
Okay, so back to the Shafiq.
But how I came, when I started looking into his oeuvre, I found this paper that had to do with the effects of polyester on sperm count and also sexual activity. And in it was this unbelievable, it's in the book, illustration, a line drawing with a rat dressed in a little little polyester pants with a little hole for his tail and a little drawstring. And the caption said, "The underpant worn by the rat." And it was just this wonderful and extraordinary. And so at that point I said, I have to meet this man. This guy dressed rats in polyester pants.
Gotta meet him.
And the amazing thing is, when I got there, he's wearing this just wonderful, shiny, royal blue suit. And I leaned over, I was like, it's polyester! And he goes, yes, polyester, but inside, never! So that was Professor Shafiq. He passed away in October, sadly. But he was one of the few real guys still just doing it for the sake of the science and figuring out the anatomy. Now, not funded by a pharmaceutical company, not...
Right. Yeah. That's a big point, really, because the pharmaceutical need, you know, the need to make money from the research really then drives the research for the most part.
Yeah, and it makes my life difficult because drug studies are no fun at all to report on, write about. But there's a lot of, of course, everybody, the Holy Grail being the female Viagra or the female libido drug, so there's lots of that going on, which is just not very entertaining.
No.
But, yeah.
Since man-made fibers are coming back in, what were the effect of those polyester?
Oh, products? Yes. results were that cotton was the polyester did in fact lower the sperm count, but that he went on this whole thing about electrostatic potentials. It seemed to me it was just that it made it too hot in there, and that's not an optimum temperature for sperm production. And the fact that the rats were having sex left less often. Well, I mean, look at the guy. You know, I mean, it's a little drawstring, you know, pants. So that was.
But you'd have to say not a reliable birth control method, the polyester underpant.
No, not. But that he was actually advocating that he made this little polyester scrotal sling as a birth control device.
Oh my God.
That he was having. There's photographs of these men wearing these little.
Is hot.
Hot. Oh yeah.
Over here.
Having written Stiff and now Boink.
Bonk,
excuse me. I'll take that I for 100. Did you have any encounters or experience or insight to necrophilia?
Oh, wow. Brave you. I came across, every now and then people, of course, would bring it up with me because I'm a natural person to bring that topic up with. And I learned a few disturbing things. Like someone said, oh, there's a mortuary in Las Vegas where if you pay enough money, oh yeah, they'll set someone aside for you. So with that, I didn't follow up on that. So that's, I have a footnote about necrophilia and stiff, which deals, actually it's a look at the language used by different states, statutes, anti-necrophilia statutes. And some of them are just quite, you know, like the plain states are very, sort of, nobody may, you know, do anything funny with a dead person. Whereas, you know, in Nevada, it's like, no, you know, oral sex, rectal sex, you can't do that. You can't. I mean, it's just this long, exuberant list of things you might actually do with a dead body.
Couldn't you marry one, though? You probably can.
Easily, yes. Yeah. And you could have Elvis do it.
No problem. Yes, you.
Moi.
Moi. Two.
I'm honored. I was in the medical ultrasound field.
Aha!
About 10 years ago or so, and I apologize for bringing the UPSOC thing back again, but back in the day, they were reporting that there was this phenomenon of surfing sperm.
I missed this!
You
oh,
missed
no.
this?
Yeah, no, I didn't hear
we'll
it.
Talk.
Wow.
We'll
okay,
talk.
We'll
afterwards.
Talk, yeah. Surfing sperm. You know how this pains me to know that there were surfing sperm out there. But anyway, what are they? They surf on... Waves of...
The uterine wall had been observed kind of rippling.
Okay. And they were...
Exactly.
That's very Age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, they didn't say anything about whether they were goofy foot or not. But that was sort
wow.
of a visually
Thank
observed.
Thank you. That's...
Welcome.
Gosh.
So now we have outer space and underwater imagery.
Yes.
To take home.
Surfing sperm.
Wow. Oh, wait. Up. Whoa. In the hat.
Hi. Forgive my ignorance. I have not read your book, although I plan to. I'm just curious if you came across any studies. This is kind of a twofold question. Did you come across any studies where you saw that the social mores of the day or particular prejudices of the individual scientists affected either their mm-hmm. theorem they were trying to prove or their outcome? And did you see any studies at any point in history that just came to a completely incorrect outcome?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, that's a great question. I have a chapter that has to do with hormones and how, you know, hormones and sex drive, and I was spent some time at the Yerkes Primate Center in Emory, and they were doing some observations of an enclosure that had a bunch of rhesus monkeys, and the researcher was showing me how, you know, the females that were ovulating, which is basically were very out front of just going up to the males and like slapping their fists down, saying, "Hey, look at me, come on!" And for years and years, it was believed that the females were completely passive. Female primates were passive, and that they were exuding a pheromone that would then cause the males to copulate with them. But that is not true. They don't. They did a lovely study that involved some lavages of the, no, this like washings of the, never mind. But they, anyway, it, as it turned out, the females are initiating sex when they're fertile. They're just, they completely ignore the males at other times, but they'll just march right up and make eye contact and do these little subtle things like, you know, because primatologists, almost all of whom at that time were male, were just assuming that the female was passive and that the male had to be initiating sex, and that kind of thing comes up a lot. Yeah, yeah.
That chapter I loved when you went out to. They were telling about the going out to bars.
The researcher said, because he would be describing, say, okay, because he'd narrate for me because I couldn't tell one rhesus monkey from another. I know. They all look alike. So he would say, you know, he'd say, okay, so now she's coming over just to pretend she's picking up that rock, but really what she's doing, you know, it's like going to the punch bowl when the cute guy is going to the punch bowl. And I said, God, do you watch people this way? Oh, yeah, we used to go to bars and just say that person's going to hook up with that person. No, she's going to the jukebox because he's going to the jukebox. It was fascinating.
Wow.
Actually.
And was there the second part of that question did you get?
The second part was... studies that were wrong?
Yes, studies that came to a wrong conclusion.
Oh, yeah, well, the coital interlocking, that carried on for centuries, that belief that was the reason people would have trouble conceiving, was that there wasn't a good interlock. God, what else? I'm sure there were...
Well, the primate thing was wrong.
Yeah. Right.
So good.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, wow. Let's go to this quadrant. A lot happening over here.
Has any aspect of your studies enhanced
Ed's enjoyment of sex.
Oh, God, you know, I think that we just end up talking about sex constantly because I'll just say, I read this study, blah, blah, blah. So we talk about sex all the time. And I think that's fun for, I mean, Ed was so excited, oh, you're doing sex research. That's great. And he had initially said, although he denies this now, I'll be a subject in a study. God, that sounds fun. You know, and then he found out what was involved.
I thought the point was very poignant where it was like erectile dysfunction is ED.
Yeah. And then poor Eds. I don't know if there are any Eds here, but it seems like an unfair.
Very unfair. Yeah. I think there were some more.
Among contemporary research, what was the most surprising new facts that you found?
Oh, there were lots of wonderful little items. This was surprising and enlightening that women have nocturnal erections. Just like, I mean, the clitoris is, you know, got a lot, there are a lot of parallels, but this was one I hadn't realized. And I love that they actually figured this out. They brought women in, found some women with, you know, on the larger end of the spectrum, clitorises or clitoris.
Clitorally speaking.
And attached a little strain gauge. And in fact, on the same sort of cycle that men would have a nocturnal erection, the women were also. That was interesting. Somebody's done research figuring out how much pressure is needed for penetration. The things that people have done in labs and come up with the equipment for is really kind of...
What was that number? Can you remember?
It depends, lubricated or non?
Let's go with lubricated.
All right. I think it was about 2 pounds, like basically as much as like to open a swinging kitchen door.
Which
you could also do.
That's also swinging.
Wanted to with an erection. Don't even, no hands. Look, no hands.
Two more questions. Number one.
Back in the day, there was a lot of talk about the difference between vaginal and clitoral orgasm, and then that kind of went out of vogue or whatever, and
right.
There was sort of, no, they're exactly the same. And so I was wondering, did you happen to find out where things are now?
You know, where things are now. There's a whole chapter on that. It's actually a complicated and fascinating question, but where things are at now is... there are vaginal orgasms, there are clitoral orgasms, there are, you know, there are G-spot vag. I mean, you can subdivide vaginal into G-spot and non, you know, there are so many different, Kinsey found a woman who has orgasms from having her eyebrows stroked. There was a woman who had them from brushing her teeth, and it wasn't the toothpaste, and it wasn't stimulating the gums, it was something about this motion, boom.
Wow.
There was a woman who had up to 30 just spontaneous orgasms a day, so much so that she sought out help. She was a Saudi woman, and she could. They actually said she had stopped visiting religious shrines and practicing religious rituals, which would be understandably awkward. So. just about any part of the body, you know, really. The people who have spinal cord injury develop a sensitive area over, like above the level of injury. But the thing with the vaginal orgasm argument, there was a guy, Haley Alzati, who did a study where he had women. He was trying to debunk this notion that. A vaginal orgasm is just an indirect clitoral orgasm. That the penis is indirectly stimulating the clitoris, and they're all the same. So he said, "By golly, I'm going to prove that that's wrong." So he basically mapped the erogenous areas of the vagina, made sure he wasn't stimulating the clitoris at all, and said, "By golly, I made them have orgasms." So it was a G-spot study. But he was one of the first that said, no, it's not just... what Masters and Johnson said is it's traction on the labia pulling the clitoris, and that's why. That they're all clitoral orgasms and that there's no other kind. But there's just... So one researcher said, it's like scotch. There's blended orgasms, and there's single malt, you know? So you got all, you know, all you can have a little, you know, little mental imagery, a little nipple, a little this, a little that, or you can have just the one. So,
wow.
I don't really remember what exactly the
question was,
but that. But it's in the book, yeah.
I think ending with the variety of orgasms and how different it all is.
Yeah,
and you know. At one point, you know, they say, one of the scientists say, you know, sex is the most important subject that there is. Did you end up feeling that?
the most important subject that there. Well, there was a great quote from John Watson, who was behaviorist who he was known for. You know, he did conditioning, like he conditioned a fear of white rats in that little kid, little Albert, and he was just sort of the first person to bring humans into the laboratory and to say that human behavior should be studied in a laboratory setting, including human sexual behavior. Unfortunately, he was having an affair with one of his students and got caught, and it was a messy divorce, and there was a rumor that actually the papers, the scientific papers, were being introduced in the court, which was not true. But what I was going to say is that he had this wonderful quote saying, like, that problems with sex, there's no greater source of human wreckage, or you know, so he said that we need to be studying this, and that the number of lives destroyed by unhappy marriages and bad sex is, I mean, it's just a tragedy that we're not looking into it, and that we, you know. So he was a very passionate advocate of studying sex.
It's heartfelt research.
It was heartfelt, and it was sad because he ended up working for an advertising agency, going around interviewing people about rubber boots. There was this scene of him going door to door, and it was sad because he was this brilliant researcher. But
Yeah. It's sad, and yet now we have Bonk.
And now we have Bonk.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Roach, Bonk. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.